Chapter 98. The Heart of Sidney Grice. We did not speak over dinner. We hardly spoke at all now except in monosyllables. Sidney Grice made no attempt to converse, but browsed lackadaisically through some scientific tome. I chewed and swallowed automatically, hardly noticing what was on my plate and not even bothering with a book. Molly cleared, having failed to lure Spirit with a dripping frond of cabbage for a ride in the dumb waiter. And we adjourned downstairs. "I cannot work at this again," I said.
"As you wish."
He selected some reading matter from the pile beside his chair. "Tell me about that locket," I said unintentionally loudly, and Mr. G. closed his journal.
"It was before your parents had even met."
He squeezed his right eyelids together. I reached for the pot and caught my cup with my sleeve, knocking it onto the hearth. "Uncle Tolly told me that my mother had an understanding with an Oxford undergraduate," I prompted, and he shrank back in his chair. "But you studied at Cambridge."
"I went to Oxford first. But there were too many memories, and I detested the architecture."
He took on a hunted expression.
"Spires should point, and nothing more. They have no business to be dreaming."
"Memories of what?" I pressed, and Sidney Grice's right eyelids crept apart again.
"You must promise that you will not tell a soul, nor make a written record of what I am about to tell you, for at least 60 years.
He rested his hands on his knees. "You have my word," I promised, and though I knew he had no high opinion of that, he took it. Sidney Grice interlocked his fingers in his lap.
"Your mother and I were in love,"
he admitted at last.
"I was not in a position to marry her, but I had asked her father's permission to make my intentions clear, and he readily agreed. It was hinted that I should take over the running of his clog-making factory, for I had a particular and violent aversion to bootlaces at the time. I took your mother boating on the Cherwell, having meticulously planned a picnic in our third favourite meadow."
"Why not one of the other two?"
"The second had been given over to a particularly cantankerous Hereford bull," he explained impatiently, "and the first was, of course, in Bavaria, a little far by punt, as even you might imagine."
Sidney Grice fell silent. Did he believe his tale to be complete? What happened? He lowered his head.
"We had rounded a bend and the meadow was in sight. The champagne was chilling over the side."
I did not want to interrupt his account by pointing out that he abhorred alcohol, but he broke off into another reverie. "And?"
"A pack of jackdaws swooped down, doubtless attracted to the party-coloured buttons on my red and blue striped waistcoat."
He ran both hands through his hair to the back of his neck.
"They alarmed me, March."
"Were you already frightened of birds by that time?" I asked gently.
"Since I was 7 years and 1 day old, he concurred. "I stepped back and the boat rocked. Your mother jumped up to save me, and the punt capsized."
His hands worked round to take him in a stranglehold.
"I could not swim, for I was always too embarrassed."
He could not quite bring himself to say that it was because of his short right leg. "And my mother was tipped in, too."
He exhaled. "I was thrown into the branches of a Salix babylonica, a weeping willow with an effulgent crop of golden catkins. But your mother fell into the water, and she could not swim either. I looked about me for a pole or some flotation device, but the boat had drifted away and your mother was being dragged under by the weight of water on her lovely dress."
His thumbs rotated round each other.
"I readied myself to go in after her."
"Even though?"
"Even though," he agreed. "But as I was disentangling myself, another man jumped in. Connie, your mother, had gone under, only her beautiful golden hair on the surface to mark where she was. Then even that became submerged. I dived in, and her hand broke through the surface. Somehow I managed to clutch it and sank with her. At least we would die together, I thought. But then I was aware of the other man grabbing my coat and being hauled up, and both of us being towed to the bank and dragged out onto it. "Foolish pup," our saviour upbraided me. "You might have drowned the most beautiful girl on whom I have ever clapped eyes." I lay prone, coughing up river water, and saw a tall, sturdily constructed man with military moustaches.
"My father," I guessed.
Mr. G's thumbs revolved furiously. He scooped Connie up as easily as you might lift spirit. "Follow me," he said, and carried her off across our once third favourite meadow, to a hostelry, but I slunk away. It was 3 miles to where I was living, but I could not face walking through the streets of Oxford. I marched for the rest of the day and all night until a van of chickens stopped and took me to London. I never returned to Oxford. I did not even get my very special things sent on.
His thumbs were stilled.
1 month later, I got a letter from your mother expressing her disgust that I had not even troubled to go with them to the inn to be sure that she was safe and comfortable. I could not tell her that I was too ashamed. And with the news that she was to marry our rescuer. He closed his left eye and forced the right to follow suit, his fingers jabbing, plucking at the glass eye whose original was buried in Charlottenburg Cemetery.
"And yet you became my godfather," I observed.
Sidney Grice covered his face. "It was your father's idea. I suspect he felt guilty, having not realized my situation when he proposed to your mother, and I imagined that she had come to appreciate how humiliating the episode had been for me and wished to make amends. But of course..."
He blew noisily into his hands.
"Your mother did not live to see you christened. Your father and I became allies, united in part by our joint loss."
He clutched his cheeks and leaned his head back.
"She was the most staggeringly beautiful person I shall ever meet."
His voice slowed.
"And I do not mean just her appearance."
"Is that why you went missing in the '60s?
"I was never missing."
"Nobody knew where you were."
"I did."
"And that was it?" I picked up my cup unbroken and meditated. Perhaps it was true. We are none of us who we pretend to be. "Why did your revolver not fire?"
I held the cup handle back, but it would never glue.
"I saw him slip the safety catch."
Sidney Grice rubbed his left eye, which was still inflamed, though the sight was restored. "It has 3 safety devices, or I should not have surrendered it so readily."
My guardian slipped his 3rd finger through the jackal ring on his watch chain.
"He was a good man,"
he said hesitantly, and I did not need to ask who he meant.
"That was a fine piece of detective work, deducing that the maids had not answered the door."
I waited for my guardian to add that he could have done so himself, but he continued,
"And it was quick thinking on his part to pretend to know that my cane was a Morse key."
This was the first time he had mentioned George since the funeral. My guardian worked his lips against each other. His head was still back.
"I know that I vexed you about not getting married, but I would not have stood in your way."
I gazed at him in wonder. This mean-hearted, big-hearted man. "Look at me," I said at last, and his eye opened reluctantly, seemingly surprised to find me still there. And when I had his full attention, I said shakily, "I love you."
My guardian chewed his upper lip and then his lower. "And since the moment we met, I have always loved,"
he told me hesitantly.
"A good cup of tea."
And Sidney Grice did not attempt to duck as my cushion hurtled towards him.